My name's Pablo Navarrete. I'm the co-editor of Alvarado, an independent website covering Latin American politics, media, and culture. I'm delighted to have with us today, and I've just been told the fourth speaker is on her way, so that's good. We have a great panel that will be exploring a very broad issue, but from a variety of perspectives, and we'll be looking at this issue of solidarity with Chile that came after the coup in 1973. As you know, or probably know, the September will mark the 50th anniversary of the coup in Chile this September. And so there's lots planned. Maria is here from the Chile 50 Years UK. Well, she's wearing various hats, but she can explain more about that initiative. And we have Sergio, a former political prisoner, Dr. Sergio Vasquez. We have Melanie Cruz, an academic at the University of Leicester, who's on her way, and we have Mike Gatehouse, who was involved in the Chile Solidarity campaigns in the 70s and 80s. So we're going to be looking at the issue of solidarity with Chile, but also exploring Chile today, the issue of struggle and the fact that, you know, struggle has never stopped, both against the dictatorship and now with a new sort of, however we want to define that government, centre-left, left-wing, the issue of struggles and those, I guess, ideals that were embodied in the Salvador Allende government that still a mass of Chilean people are still fighting for them today, close to 50 years after the coup. So the order, the way we'll do it today is that Maria will begin, and I think she will address both those issues, solidarity here and the issue of Chile. Then this will be followed by Sergio, who again, will address both issues. I think with Mike, I think you'll concentrate on the issue of solidarity. But obviously, we have carte blanche to talk about, you know, whatever you want. And then Melanie, I think, will concentrate on the issue of Chile today. She's written a number of very good articles for Tribune on Chilean, contemporary Chilean politics. And so she'll concentrate on Chile. And then we'll make sure there's enough time to have a good amount of time for questions and comments. And as always, let's keep it to questions. And if you do have a comment, make it brief, but let's get as many questions in as possible. So, Maria.
Yeah, thank you, Babylon. Thank you all for coming today. So as we know, it's a really important year for not just Chileans, I think, but everybody that remembers a coup for all the different reasons 50 years ago this year. So firstly, just I think to give you a bit of background of Chile Solidarity and in fact of the exile community, which is what I'm a member of and something that I'm also studying in my PhD. So Pinochet's coup happens, he uses exile as a repressive tool. So we see within months of the coup, people being exiled, expelled from the country by the regime. And it's estimated between, I think the lowest estimation is about 200,000 people leaving, the highest is up to about 2 million. So the range is probably somewhere in between. But Chile at the time was only a population of 10 million, so it's a big proportion of the country that had to leave. Some people had their sentences commuted on the basis that they left the country. And the Chile diaspora becomes vast. Over 119 countries in the world receive Chilean refugees. And the exile doesn't officially end till 1989, so it's a long period of exile. And actually, academics have argued that that's what makes Chile's exile experience and consequentially solidarity distinct. It's not unique. We see exiles coming out from Argentina after the coup there in 1976. Obviously, Uruguay is also 1973. But it makes it different because of how long the dictatorship lasted, because how many countries received the Chileans, and because of how visible the Chilean exile community becomes. Juan Pablo Letelier, Orlando Letelier's son, Orlando Letelier that was murdered in Washington under the auspices of Operation Condor, along with Ronnie Moffitt. He talks about there's no one important city in the world that hasn't seen a Chilean or an empanada. So, you know, it becomes very vast. So Chileans become well known. In terms of the UK receives about 3,000. It's not until Labour is brought in 1974 that the refugee programme begins. And the process is slow, hence why, compared to other European countries, actually the proportion's quite small. And then, obviously, Chile Solidarity campaign, and we've got Mike Gay out here that can talk to us more about that, was set up within days of the coup. And this happened all across the UK. Groups began to spring up at grassroots level and then became part of the larger network of Chile Solidarity campaign. And not just in the UK, we see 80 countries, it's estimated, creating their own Chile Solidarity campaigns. Organisations such as Amnesty International, so the membership of Amnesty International, for example, grew from 3,000 to 50,000 between 1974 and 1976. So you see this whole plethora of people coming together, being drawn, maybe in some of the people I've interviewed talked about the images of the La Moneda being bombed, which some of you may have seen as well, talked about it coming on the back of Vietnam, knowing at the time that the CIA were involved, even though they denied it, and having an anger about this US imperialism, once again, trampling on somewhat, you know, on a country's desire to choose a different government. And within that, obviously, solidarity begins straight away. And like I said, I don't want to take away from, you know, Mike's got first-hand experience of doing this. So I was going to just look at the role of the exiles within that solidarity movement. Because, as we know, contrary to much of the not right-wing narrative that we hear now around refugees and asylum seekers and any migrants, people don't just come here and then, you know, get a council house and, you know, nick the jobs or whatever. People come and are agents in their own right, and you see this within the Chilean exile community. As, more or less as soon as Chileans land, the first generation lands, they become politically active, literally from prison to being exile to being become politically active and start getting involved. And not all, but in general, many of the Chileans that came were politicised already. They'd had 3 years of, you know, popular unity government. There's a reason why they were thrown out in the first place. So they bring all this political vigour and energy and desire to fight, to continue the fight and do so in the UK and across the world, obviously. So they start aligning in terms of political parties. This is across Europe. So you see the Socialist Party reform, MEED, the Communist Party. You see the CUT, which is the TUC equivalent, reforming in exile. So they start mirroring what the activities that's happening in Chile, but out in exile, and start working with groups such as Chile Solidarity Campaign, Academics for Chile, the joint working group that was later set up, Labour Party sent up a separate parliamentary group as well. All these groups start forming this network around the whole solidarity movement. But what's also interesting that I know from personal experience, but also has been confirmed within my research, that Chileans didn't just focus on solidarity with Chile. Chileans also got involved in other Latin American solidarities. No doubt Sophia might talk about in Sheffield, the Chilean exile community formed the Latin American Solidarity Front, which encompassed Nicaragua, El Salvador, other solidarity campaigns at the time. We got involved in British politics. The miners' strike is one that springs to mind. There's a book by Jean Stead, who she's a former wife of a miner. She helped set up a lot of the soup kitchens, etc., in Wales. And she specifically, in her book, talks about the Chileans coming to their camp, to the pit in Wales and giving money. And this was mirrored across the country. Anti-apartheid movement, Palestine movement, you know, Troops Against Northern Ireland. I could list you all the events and activities that I was dragged to as a child, that my parents were involved, along with the other Chilean compañeros and compañeras. So it wasn't just, there was a real sense of internationalism. Chileans brought with them an understanding that what happened in Chile was the beginning. And actually, sadly, that came to fruition. As we put on our leaflet, you know, what we got by the bullet, you got by the ballot box in 1979 with Margaret Thatcher, the same neoliberal programme rolled out and the crushing of rights as a consequence. But what's also very interesting about the solidarity experience with the Chileans is that it carries on up until obviously 1990, but when the dictatorship ends, the political action doesn't end. So what we see is in subsequent years, for different reasons, the networks are reactivated. And I'll briefly touch upon those. But also what we see is the impact on people like me, on people like Bavlo, on people like Isabel, who's here today, the impact on the second generation Chileans. We've grown up in the solidarity events. We've been at the parties, you know, playing with each other while the adults were talking politics and fundraising vigorously. So when we grow up, we start becoming active. Not all of us, obviously, but there's a chunk that start becoming active. So solidarity is not just about the immediate. What I found is that it sows the seeds for future political action, not just by that generation, but by the generations that follow. So what we see, for example, then, in 1998, Pinochet's arrested in London. And this forms this massive spontaneous gathering of this exile community that maybe had lost contact, that start going to where he is held and following him wherever he is. And El Piquete is born, which literally means like the picket line. But behind El Piquete, there was lots of networks that started to be formed, informally and formally. So obviously, you know, as we know, this was brought from Spain, his extradition, but we start working with Amnesty International's lawyers here, Byman and Partners, Medical Foundation start supporting. We see people like Jeremy Corbyn coming to the picket that had been supportive during those years before. And we also see just ordinary people getting involved again. Jack Straw wrote that he received over 70,000 letters during the Pinochet campaign. Now remember, this is before online petitioning, it's before Facebook, it's before any social media. The internet was new, yet the Chileans and their supporters managed to garner that much support. By the time that shamefully Jack Straw sent Pinochet back, four European countries were wanting his extradition: Spain, France, Belgium and Switzerland. And that was because of the exile communities within those countries, between them, start of collating legal cases and putting cases forward. I was involved in the translation of cases here in London. So the massive diaspora working behind the scenes to try and get this man extradited. I've not got much time left, so just to finish, we then see Eco Memoria, Memoria Viva formed, which is a planting of trees in the memory of the disappeared, the collecting of these testimonies, which is so important for future cases. We also in 2013 see Chile 40 years on. I see some compañeros from the time that helped us with that. And this is where this activism continues to happen. And when Chile despertó in 2019, those active networks reactivated and we came together and we come full circle, going on to Sergio, because Sergio, a former political prisoner, then helped a group in University of Sheffield support a political prisoner during the times of El Estadillo in 2020. So I know that we're pushed for time, but I just want to make that say thank you to all of you that were here and supported us in any moment of those 50 years, but also to say that what you did wasn't just about that moment, it was about what you helped us do in sowing the seeds of future political action and resistance. Memory, conserving memory, is a political act. Thank you.
Before I just want to flag up that in the next session, we'll be showing a film called Santiago Rising. Some of you might have seen it, by Nick McWilliam, who edits Alborada with me, and he made his first film, an excellent documentary, and he'll be showing an extract, and it's around the uprising that started in October 2019 in Chile. And Maria will be joining Nick for a short Q&A after the extract, so that's after this session, if anyone wants to see that. So, Sergio.
Right. Thank you. I think Maria put a lot of questions over the table. I think and his speech was quite good in terms of summarizing a few things. But and in that sense, I want just to congratulate the second generation for organizing this kind of activity within the Chile Solidarity Network, also outside them. So congratulations to them for this. You know, carry on with the 50 year. First of all, in order to understand, this show of solidarity We have to understand what happened in Chile. You know, we have to go back. You know, for us, 1970 was perhaps the most important thing what happened. So I just, you know, summarize. I want to summarize a little bit what happened during that period. So 11 September was really a terrible, 1973 was a social earthquake, I would call it. It was terrible. I think, as I put it, just the night before, our hearts were beating with enthusiasm. We have a lot of energy. There were too many tasks to do, too many things, too many aims to accomplish. And a lot of reasons why to celebrate those days. Okay? So that was, you know, 11 September 1993, the day, you know, the night before the coup. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, everything stopped. Nothing moved. Right. So it was like a tsunami. Yeah. Came to your house, destroyed your house. That's you know, a good parallel. Mm-hmm. Indeed, the victory of Allende in 1970. It brought millions of people into the political scene. There was big sympathy for this new road to socialism, right? And this created, I think, not only in Chile, all over the world. Yeah. There was a big discussion about this, you know, new road to socialism. And this you know, was pursued by the agenda. And this you know, movement was very strong, quite dramatically strong. During the first time in Allende, the first month, what Allende did immediately, they increased the salary by 37%. All the people have 37% more in their pocket in the first month. And then, after that, what they did is release all the political prisoners from the MIR in that time, which have confronting the previous government, Frei government. Mm. And the other thing that he did, he dissolved the riot police straight away. So that's why, you know, as soon as Allende came to power, he did that measure, which resonated you know, quite strongly. Of course, as the process went along, you know, Allende government nationalized the copper industry, nationalized some banks, you know, deepened and extended the agrarian reform, right, and modified the welfare system and the public health. So that, you know, put the people, instead of going down because of the propaganda from the right, increase you know, the participation of the people straight away. And I should remember that you know, the election in 1971, which were municipal election on that day, Allende won 50%. So it was you know, 49.74 exactly percent. He won that amount of people on the first year. So you can see you know, the vibration that the Chile society was at that time. So, of course, we have the ruling economical elite and the political, you know, parties of the center, Christian Democrats, some part of the radical party, you know, and the Partido Nacional, the National Party, which were, you know, the right wing in those days. They were not happy with this. Of course, the CIA was not happy, and United States were not happy. So, and because of all this impetu and the demonstration in the street, they formed you know, a unified front, which was the Confederación Democrática, with this democratic confederation. And they contested fiercely any advance of the you know, popular unity in those days. As it go along with the time, they created havoc in the economy, right? They created, you know, problem with the distribution system with the lorry strike, so that they starve the population because there is no way how you transport basic element for their daily living. Mm. They also, you know, the press in those days was totally against the government. Yeah, that's one of the weakness, you know, within this, you know, the government that it didn't have a good press, except you know some of the press which was the we call it a red press, which little by little was transformed, you know, at the Clarín, you know, it was a press which soon took you know the you know ideas of the government and then you know become one of the leading press, popular press. I refer to popular press, right? So El Clarín was probably the only diario from the media that supported Allende. Mm-hmm. All the rest were against Allende, right? And of course, the CIA tried to avoid from the very beginning, with the assassination of the commander-in-chief, Schneider, before Allende took power. And they carry on working on that, right? So the situation, every year was, every measure was taken, the people got more responsibility, they took, yeah. So this is the basis, of why, when the exile community arrives here, or whatever, in whatever part we came, that is the basis why, the solidarity was so strong. And the people was, having in this mind this conception of society which we are creating at that time, right? So, I'm sorry I have to stand in that area, but that explains, the force that we have when we came here. After that, it came the coup, and the coup created, it was like I said, a night and day. And I was taken prisoner in 1975, but to get to the 1975, we went to a resistance. So survival and resistance was what we have to do in those days. And, after the passing for different concentration camps in Chile, very famous Villa Grimaldi, and then, the army camp in Valparaiso, Villa Grimaldi, and all the others, Tres Alamos, Cuatro Alamos, all the concentration camps that you may know, even the Roca de San Antonio. Then we were liberated. I stayed in Chile until 1978. And during those times, the solidarity that we received from the other people was very, very important for our survival. Even at the time of the resistance, we have solidarity from other people, right? I remember during the time of the resistance, we go to visit some comrades, to meetings, and put the right in Moscow at the time and hear all the story what happened around the world. That's the only communication we have with the external world. There was no communication apart from the press, the foreign press. You can ask sometimes, in English or in French, you can read the news. But that's the communication that we have on those days. So solidarity was received in the concentration camp. We received after we were liberated. When we stayed in Chile after 1978, we received letter from Norway, expressing their solidarity with help, with money even, right? So this kind of thing have a very big impact on the Chilean community which are right here. And that's why, again, we developed that kind of, a couple of minutes and I will finish. When I arrived here, that was 1978, already, there was a big, movement of solidarity. There have been 5 years of solidarity. We have the association, the CAF, committee, anti-fascist committee, which was mainly from the Chilean, and there was the Solid Chile Solidarity Campaign, and well, there was all the organization. And one important thing that this was very important is that the Chilean had probably the most organized exile. I don't see any community who have such organization of the exile, right? And this organization of the exile allow us, at the time when I arrived, it was already done there, partly. But as the struggle in Latin America changed dramatically, as they keep the organization within the community, as a community, and they keep the organization within, the Chilean society, in different aspects, going everywhere. So that organization, they created a lot of things. They have a group of theater going everywhere. They have, musical group, everything. You have it, everything. That kind of solidarity we offered to the English people. So there was a lot of English people who participated in our people. From where I arrived in a town, in a small town there, in Rotherham, in the north of England, And, you know, the children who went to school, we did activity in their school, right? And we brought our thing to there. And so, you know, it was a community activity. Maybe that's the reason why, you know, this was so strong. Anyway, this have been always, as Maria said, you know, later on when the uprising in Chile came in 2019, this revived with a lot of strength again, and we returned back this, you know, by creating, well, they created the Chile Solidarity Network, the second generation, and through them, then we can, you know, appeal to the people here and show that in Chile, again, we have political prisoners who we should work and communicate with them. The communication was more easy than it was before, but we adopted the political prisoner, which we finally get it out of the jail. That was, you know, our main thing. So, I mean, I don't know. I have to give it time soon, so I end here.
Thank you very much, Sergio. And you mentioned the role of the media in Chile, and just to flag up another session that Alborá has organized in the afternoon on 2:40 called Latin America Mainstream Media Misrepresentation and the Independent Media Fight Back. And I think that issue is crucial today. I mean, in Chile, you had El Mercurio, CIA-funded media baron group, and you have them all over Latin America. And these media organizations, as they do in the UK and everywhere, play a profoundly anti-democratic role in basically against the left, against progressive forces. So I think it's an issue that those of us on the left, we have to really engage with how we deal with that. So we have two more speakers. We have Mike, who's going to, again, concentrate on this issue of solidarity from the English or British side. And then Melanie, after, will focus on the contemporary issues around solidarity and struggle in the Boric government. So I'm sure we'll have plenty to debate in the questions. So, Mike.
Yeah. Several people in the room appear to be too young to remember 1973 in detail. I was young then, believe it or not, but I think it's difficult for us to imagine actually quite what the impact of the Chilean coup was. I mean, Chile was a country profoundly unknown, distant, tiny, remote, with which Britain had relatively little recent contact. It had in the 19th century. So for most people in Britain, Chile was, you know, a little country a very long way away. When the move towards the formation of Popular Unity and the election of Salvador Allende was underway, people within the Labour movement in Britain were already becoming interested. Jeremy Corbyn, as you may know, went to Chile before 1970. A number of British trade unionists, Labour leaders and others either went to Chile during the Popular Unity period or formed at least contacts with people from Popular Unity. But still, the knowledge and experience, the amount of exchange was very small. And yet, when the coup happened, the scale of mobilization, of publicity, of front pages of newspapers, of people making declarations, of people spontaneously going to the Chilean embassy, initially to demonstrate solidarity with Álvaro Wunster, the Popular Unity ambassador at the time, and then when he was forced to leave the embassy. So there was a huge, really spectacular outburst of feeling about what was going on in Chile. Not an informed feeling in many cases, but it was great. And I think it reflected a number of different things. One is that this was a period, if you like, in the middle of the Cold War. The Cold War obviously was well established long since, but it was the middle of the Cold War, and a period when the Cold War was kind of going stale and people were beginning to question the very basis of it, and in particular, beginning to question the role of the United States. For many British people, the US was our ally in the Second World War. They had helped us massively with troops and with aid to emerge victorious from the war in 1945. And the questioning of the US, which obviously began in Britain most significantly with questioning the whole Vietnam campaign, but it came, was strengthened immeasurably and came to the fore when the coup in Chile happened and then with the formation of Chile Solidarity. Into the Solidarity campaign came a number of different organizations. ABCF, the Association for British Chilean Friendship, which was the sort of friendship society with the Popular Unity Chilean Embassy, and embraced academics, a number of artists, actors, and others. They started to organize immediately when the coup happened. Came the trade unions, and I'll say a lot more about those in a minute. Came the Labour Party and the Communist Party, and also the parties of whatever you want to call it, tended to get called the ultra-left, perhaps that's not a fair, let's say the new left, if you like, at the time. Mostly it was at the time IS, the International Socialist, the precursor to the SWP, and was the International Marxist Group and some other smaller groupings. So all of these came together loosely. Together also, it should be said, with a lot of academics who rapidly formed Academics for Chile, and started to envisage the need to receive Chileans who'd been expelled from the universities or their student courses. All of these came together very rapidly in the last 3 months of 1973 after the coup on the 11th of September. I wasn't around because I was in Chile at the time. And important also were the very small number of Britons who, for often coincidental reasons, had been in Chile, had either witnessed the coup. In my case, I was arrested. I was in the National Stadium in Santiago briefly, and then had to leave the country under a safe conduct, arriving back in Britain in October. So those Britons obviously were immensely shocked, moved, motivated to try and do something. And so we became involved quickly in the campaign. And I started to work full-time for Chile Solidarity right at the end of 1973 and carried on until 1979. And I'll come back again to the role of these Britons because it's a byproduct of Solidarity. And just as Sergio talked about the effect of this upon the Chileans who were in exile and the things they've gone on to do subsequently, there was also a whole range of British people who'd either been in Chile or been active in the Solidarity campaign and went on afterwards and are still around doing things on Latin America or other progressive causes. So Solidarity, one of the byproducts of Solidarity is that it raises the consciousness of a lot of people who may not have been very political before, and it commits them into a channel of activity which is often lifelong. And that it's enormously important because Chile Solidarity in turn fueled Nicaragua Solidarity and the various other Latin American solidarities since. And if you did a sort of organigram of the people involved, you could see how that's gone on. The wonderful El Sueño Existe Festival, which takes place in Mijantles every year, was founded, I think, by Tony Corden, a young...
Keith Jackson. From Chile Solidarity.
And Tony, who was a musician who got obsessed about Victor Jara and then wanted to have a Victor Jara festival in Wales, and this from tiny beginnings involving Welsh folk singers in both Welsh language and English, it went on and has become this wonderful festival that's been taking place ever since. When was the first one?
The first one was 2005.
Right.
There were Chilean music nights in Mijantles between 2000 and 2005, but the first three-day festival was 2005. And I have the leaflet for 2023 here, which will be focusing on Chile 50 and celebrating all of the art and music and poetry and so on, a Popular Unity above all, and but denouncing the coup, of course, and celebrating Solidarity. Yeah. September it's going to be set up, 16th or September.
Everyone should go.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. And Pablo will be involved in shaping the programme as well.
I could sort of go on for a very long time and bore everyone, because there's an enormous amount that could be said about Chile Solidarity.
Oh, it's the dreaded 1 minute now.
I won't. But let me just name a few short things. One is the enormous importance of the trade union movement. Mm. We had 30 national unions or more affiliated to the Chile Solidarity campaign. Trade unions all over Britain were involved in various ways, in boycott, the famous boycott by the Rolls-Royce workers in East Kilbride in Scotland that prevented Rolls-Royce jet engines being serviced for the Chilean Air Force, the same jet engines that powered the Hawker Hunter jets that strafed the Moneda Palace on September 11th, 1973, the Siemens boycott, boycotts of other workers elsewhere. The adoption of Chilean political prisoners, to which also Sergio referred, enormously important. Well over 200 trade union branches around the country adopted a Chilean political prisoner, and a number of those prisoners then arrived. Wonderful, we adopted the prisoner and here they are with their family. And so that fueled a vast communal movement around the local committees around the country, with people finding housing, jobs, clothing, taking the children on board. Lots of wonderful, warm, personal, humane, but also politically inspired and inspiring solidarity taking place around the country. I want to say two final things, which are not specific to solidarity, but are reflections later. I think, looking back now, we underestimated two important things. One was the extent to which the coup in Chile was a cultural coup. And if you think about the whole debate in Britain now about woke, about various forms of cultural change, which the right is already focused on very heavily, they're much more intelligent often than we are.
They probably invented.
But in Chile, the coup was profoundly a cultural coup. The burning of books, the closure of university faculties, the persecution of everyone who in any way stood for a cultural expression of progress. And perhaps most famously, in the person of Víctor Jara, the savage torture and assassination of Víctor Jara. That cultural assault was deeply important and is important in every political movement today. The second thing I think we underestimated was the economic nature of the Chilean coup. And the best analysis of this still that I've seen is in Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine. Mm. And what she shows is how much had been prepared in advance. And the military and the jets and the shootings were an aspect of a much more profound and thorough economic counter-revolution. And again, we see that going on around the world and indeed in Britain still today and in the battles around policy in Britain.
Fantastic.
Just a small comment regarding the underestimation of the economical thing, because I remember when we have discussion with different people in here, and we say, okay, this is the neoliberalism. People didn't understand until Thatcher came. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was underestimated completely. So we were talking what the hell we're talking. But in Chile we had it already, and we said this is happening. So.
Okay. Great. So. Lastly, Melanie, we're delighted, as I said earlier, Melanie's a lecturer in international relations at the University of Leicester, and she's written a number of excellent articles for Tribune on contemporary developments in Chile. So March last year, we've got a new government, the Boric government, and we can debate the exact nature of its leftism. Perhaps in the 10 minutes that we have after. But I think Melanie's going to talk about this issue of solidarity and struggle in relation to the Boric government and obviously explain why the constitutional process is that, why it got rejected. So all of that in 8 minutes. So.
Thank you. First of all, apologies for being late, but I live in Birmingham and I relied on trains, so you know what it is. they were very delayed. So sorry about that. Sorry I missed your Tokyo presentation, but I'm very sorry about that. So yeah, it's a lot to say in like 8 minutes. So I kind of condensed it in three main points. I thought it could be interesting for the conversation, and it's sort of, it's so interesting to listen to this experience because I am from the transition generation. I was born in 88, so I didn't experience the dictatorship. But I am the generation of the transition. I am the generation of the 2006 and 2011 student movement. And a lot of what we did in that period of university activism was a reflection, and very much in a mirror and a reflection of what comrades did and the resistance of the dictatorship. So there is a continuity there that I will try to just highlight in this very brief presentation. But I think I want to talk about the defeat of the constitutional process in September last year, the Boric government, and what the left, or how the left look like today, because I think there's a lot of interest in thinking about how the left is rearticulating themselves in the last few years, but particularly now with the new challenges that are coming after the defeat of the constitutional process. So there's a lot to talk about why that failed, why we lost the referendum in September, and how we, like, it was a massive defeat. It was not a near 50-50%. We just got 38% of the population to approve the constitution. And I think there are internal aspects to look at. There is a problem in the way that the left and the central left articulate in organizing the constitutional convention. And there is a lot of self-criticism going on in the left right now, thinking about how the communication, the strategy, the intervention of the convention could have been addressed better and differently at the time. And of course, there's a vast of external circumstances. We're talking about the rise of the far right, the control of the media and communications, as Pablo was talking about. It's a very important factor that played in that process. And as well, a misunderstood of what that constitutional process is going to be for Chilean people. Because this is in the back or the consequence of the social uprising of 2019, that we're not going to have much time to talk about now, but you, I assume you're pretty aware of. The constitutional process became a sort of a solution for the demands that arise in that moment. And the draft, how it was written, the content of it, did not reflect all of those demands. And it was not very easy to translate, although it was a great draft and I really liked it. It did not translate materially the demands that people were looking for at this point. So those factors play an important role of the defeat of the constitutional process. And now there is a new one. We're going to see what happens in the next coming month with a new constitutional process. But this also goes in hand with the election of Boric as the progressive alliance or the more progressive president we have had since the transition. Because he became the person in charge of dealing with this referendum. So this is also a contestation against the government. Although it's a very, very brief early government dates, because he's elected in, well, December, but he's assuming like January, March, and then the referendum is in September, so it's only a few months, but it is a contestation to this new government, a new government that is completely new, that has never been in power, with an alliance of young people that are coming from the student movement primarily, but also from all the sectors of like the new left, they haven't found their feet yet as a government. And in tension, and constant tension, because we're still seeing that tension with the traditional central left that were in government for 30 years. We're talking about the Socialist Party, the Christian Democrats, PPD, and so on. That tension between different sectors of the left has been really reflected in Boris' government in the last year. Well, not has been a year yet, but in the last 10 months or so. And there's been good sides to it and negative sides to it. And that tension will continue, in my belief, as it goes on. because what Boric is dealing with at the moment is the continuations of sort of resolving the issues of the social uprising. Again, the demands for the social of that rise in the social uprising continue to exist. So we're talking about pensions, we're talking about the health system, we're talking about educational reforms, and we're talking about, again, the constitutional process. He has to continue dealing with that and more historical issues like the crisis in the South with the Mapuche people. And of course, one of the main points of the political agenda that has been going around recently is the problem of insecurity, right? So we're getting a rise of like criminality, and that has become a very important political narrative today in Boric government, almost like taking over every point of the government. And he has to deal with the rise of a populist far right, a populist far right that is very well organized, that is in very much connection to Bolsonaro, with Donald Trump's of the world, with the far right in Europe that we all kind of more aware of. This is going in rapid rise. We're not seeing, and we're seeing it in a very organized manner. So we're seeing clearly producing a daily chaos to the government. So throwing around, for example, impeachments to high-level ministers like Georgia Jackson, who's like the right hand of Boric. By the way, it did not go through the impeachment, but that happened. It was a very sort of tension moment in the last few weeks. Because this is a continuation of a new movement of the far right that we're seeing everywhere, and that is actually happening in Chile as well. So that is also a tension that Boric will have to deal with, and a big, big challenge, because this could go both ways. So he's in a kind of like a middle position, in my opinion. He is dealing with this rise of the far-right populists, but also containing or trying to contain the diversity of the left. And how you keep those things in place is a really hard task for a government, apart from the fact that he has to actually be government, release policies, deal with Congress, and obviously run the state like any other government. So that is a very difficult position for him as a president, but for the left as whatever the left is at the moment. So where the left is at, I mean, I was listening to this really, really, for those who speak Spanish, I would really recommend it, Nodo Siglo XXI, which is like a sort of left-wing think tanks in Chile. They did a panel recently, like last week, on the task and the challenges of the left in Chile. And there was like panelists from all different political parties on the left, including the Communist Party, Convergencia Social, but also like social movements like Modadima, which is the organization for the fight in defense of water in the region of Valparaíso. One of the main discussions is like, what is the instrument that the left has? Yes, no problem. The left has at this point to sustain the government, to be in government, but at the same time being in opposition. Because that's what is the tension that we see today. Social movements are in opposition to some points against Boric government, especially related to environmental problems. But also, they have to be in government. So that tension of the left is something that they are starting just now to reflect about, and I got in the debate, because the defeat of September was really, really tough for the left to deal with. And the next steps, they seem to be related to articulating new instruments of political, new political instruments in which the whole reconfiguration of political parties, but how that is integrated with very strong social movements at the moment, will look like for maintaining and supporting Boric government in the next few years. And there's a lot of to say of what Boric is doing is good or what is bad. I mean, obviously, one of the main things that probably came out in the news is like the pardons of political prisoners, and I think that's what you were talking before, maybe, I don't know. He released a group of political prisoners that were arrested during the social uprising, and so on. But yeah, we can talk about it if you have any questions about more details, but I think that is the main struggles we're seeing today, but there is a lot of possibilities because we still have a progressive government. So I think we are continue seeing that that tension. So I'm not going to carry on because it's too much to say.
Thank you very much. So we have just under 10 minutes, so we do want to get some questions in. Just to say, we are recording this as a podcast, which will be released on the Alborada website. Chile 50 will share it. You should check out their flyers that are on the Alborada store downstairs. And there'll be lots of events at Sueño, lots of events this year in relation to Chile, looking at issues around the Boric government, solidarity from all different angles. So, yeah, stay in touch with our websites for that. So, yeah, let's take a couple, as many questions as we can. So we have one here.
Yeah, I just want to know more about the environmental policies, if that's possible.
Yeah. Should we take another one?
Do you have any quick points on a question?
Okay,
From Coventry, Darrell Cousins, Vice President of the Coventry Trade Union Council. I was looking at the picture on the wall there. It makes me feel very old, because I was active at the same time in 1973, 74 with the Chile Solidarity Campaign. And we had the campaign on three levels. One, preparing or making habitable social housing that was provided by the council, even to the extent, and excuse the language, scraping dried shit off the floors of houses so that Chilean refugee families could actually inhabit the houses. Secondly, the question of raising the issue of Chile in the wider labour and trade union movement. The point was made Chile was a faraway country, many people didn't know about it. And the third one, which is here comes the question, in relation to, because it relates to what's happening with Castillo in Peru, is the question of Allende trying to buy the loyalty of the armed forces by raising the salaries of the officer caste in the armed forces. Is it possible to use the institutions of a state which exists to protect capitalism in order to move towards socialism?
That's a simple question there.
Very good question.
So we have a question on, a concrete question on the environmental policies of the Boric government, and then we have a broader question on revolutionary change in society. So do you want to start, Melanie, with the, and obviously if any of the panel want to say anything about the environmental question, come in.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very exciting time for environmental politics in Chile. I mean, they have been building up since the 90s, so the whole responsibility of putting this into the political agenda has been by social movements of all kind. I think that's why the constitutional draft has a really kind of had a very green agenda, if you wanted to. But it is a very difficult question for the government to deal with because, again, in perhaps relation to your question, how the state deal with the contradiction between capital and development, because although, for example, recently a big mine project was rejected by the government, Dominga, that has been going for over 10 years before I moved to the UK, so a long time. So he rejected, which is a great sign for environmentalists. There is still a plan for a national industry of lithium, which will have a huge environmental impact and perhaps not much of income for the country. And that tension, because that is a government promise, because, and this is not just for Chile, I think it's a question for all Latin American countries, and there's been a lot of research recently about this. How a country can develop, how a country can grow without exploiting the only thing they have, that is natural resources, in the midst of climate change. That tension, I think, is really, really difficult to deal with. And Boric, I don't think personally he's going to resolve it because he has only 4 years to do this. So he might stop good things like Dominga, but he will carry on some pretty difficult and pretty damaging extractivist projects, I'm afraid.
Right. Can I
yeah, just quickly on that. I think Melanie's probably been more kinder to Boric than I would have been, I've got to say. And one of the criticisms at the moment of Boric, and connects to your environmental question, is a continuation of the militarisation of Gualmapu, which is the indigenous lands in the south of Chile. And a lot of what the indigenous people there, the communities there, are fighting, Mapuche predominantly, are against extractivism, and they're against the logging and the illegal use of their land. They're against the forestry, massive transnational corporations, corporations often European, Canadian, other companies that are going in and exploiting that land. So I've got a real problem with the idea of green capitalism, because I don't think it works, as we've seen the mess that we're in. And I think Boric has not, has only not been strong enough on it, but he's actually continued something that he said in opposition he would oppose, which is the indigenous people fighting for the right of their own land to protect, you know, what they know is Mother Earth, which eventually we're going to see the destruction of if we carry on.
But actually, that was a promise at the UN conference that the indigenous people would have power.
Yeah, I mean, regarding green capitalism, is it regarding to be green within a capitalist system is quite tricky, and I think one of the difficulty of all, as you said, the green movement. I mean, let's take the latest example of Annalena Baerbock. Yeah, he said recently we are at war against Russia. This is from the European Union general. Yeah, she's a green, right? But I had never heard from him what is the impact of the war into the environment. I mean, the war have a terrible impact in the environment, okay? If I am a green, you know, I should go for peace. I want to go for war, right? So yes, I mean, the green capitalism is always, you know, I don't know, there is this policy which has appeared on the latest years, you know, about identity policy and green policy, which are comparable, you know, with capitalism, are a bit iffy, you know. Yeah. They are not very clear. So on the second question about your question, I think the answer to that question was done a little bit by Venezuela. How the Venezuelan people integrated their army and, you know, and make a real army which is in favor of the people and against the imperialism.
And the Chavez.
Chavez was very clever enough to integrate that. And from the very beginning, Chavez said, one of the fundamental problems that Allende has, and he couldn't go into the military, right? And that's the way how he did it. So I think we have to study a little bit more about the Venezuelan Revolution, how they integrated this, you know, into the... Within the army, always going to be, you know, people who are going to be pro-change, you know? I mean, the assassination of Schneider the assassination of Pratt after, you know, by Pinochet, it showed that within the army, there would be, you know, people who have a more progressive approach. And the question is how you integrate that, yeah.
I'm conscious that we're going to have to end, but I do want to give Mike, if you want to say any final words or not, and just to say that, you know, it's a shame we don't have more time to continue, but, you know, as you say, podcasts will be, and we'll be doing lots of other events with more time, because there's obviously the issue of Chile has not broad resonance around leftist strategy, both the past and in the current Boric government, and there's plenty to debate. So, Mike, just
picking up the point about the environment, and this is a brief ad break. Latin America Bureau Lab, where I'm an editor, is publishing in March this year a book called The Heart of Our Earth, Community Resistance to Mining in Latin America. It's written by my son Tom, by the way. but it looks at the struggles right across the continent in different countries, including Chile, Bolivia, Argentina, Brazil, Central America, around this fundamental extractivist dilemma, which is for many countries still, certainly for Chile, for Peru, mining offers any left or progressive government, appears to offer, a means of financing social progress, education, health, etc. And that's the dilemma that governments right through Lula's first administration in Brazil and others have faced. But the communities that resist the mining projects are very clear, including the indigenous peoples in Chile, in Brazil, and elsewhere. They are the stewards of their lands, and we can all see the enormous damage that our purchase of electric cars is going to cause.